Yogacara, the basics, adapted from the article, What is, and isn't, Yogacara, by Dan Lusthaus, available at www.acmulla.net/yogacara/articles/intro.html. Yogacara is one of the two major philosophical schools of Indian Mahayana Buddhism. Its founding is ascribed to two half-brothers, Asanga and Vasubandhu, who lived 4th to 5th century CE. However, its basic tenets and doctrines were already in circulation for at least a century before the brothers lived. Yogacara focused on the processes involved in cognition, in order to overcome the ignorance that prevents one from attaining liberation from the karmic rounds of birth and death. Yogacara's attention to issues such as cognition, consciousness, perception, and epistemology, together with claims such as external objects do not exist, has led some to misinterpret Yogacara as a form of metaphysical idealism. They did not focus on consciousness to assert it as ultimately real. Yogacara claims consciousness is only conventionally real since it arises from moment to moment due to fluctuating causes and conditions, but rather because it is the cause of the karmic problem they are seeking to eliminate. Yogacara introduced several important new doctrines to Buddhism, including Vijñaptimātra, nothing but cognition, three self-natures, three turnings of the Dharma wheel, and a system of eight consciousness, all explained below. Their close scrutiny of cognition spawned two important developments, an elaborate psychological therapeutic system that mapped out the problems in cognition along with the antidotes to correct them, and an earnest epistemological endeavor that led to some of the most sophisticated work on perception and logic ever engaged in by Buddhists or Indians. 1. Historical overview. Though the founding of Yogacara is traditionally ascribed to Asanga and Vasubandhu, most of its fundamental doctrines had already appeared in a number of scriptures a century or more earlier, most notably the Sandinamokana Sutra, elucidating the hidden connections. Among the key Yogacara concepts introduced in the Sandinamokana Sutra are the notions of only cognition, Vijñaptimātra, three self-natures, Trisvabhava, the Alaya Vijnana, storehouse consciousness, overturning the basis, Ashraya, Perivarati, and the theory of eight consciousnesses. The Sandinamokana Sutra proclaimed its teachings to be the third turning of the wheel of Dharma. Buddha lived around the 5th century BCE, but Mahayana sutras did not begin to appear until roughly 500 years later. New Mahayana sutras continued to be composed for many centuries. Indian Mahayanists treated these sutras as documents that recorded actual discourses of the Buddha. By the 3rd or 4th century CE, a wide and sometimes incommensurate range of Buddhist doctrines had emerged, but whichever doctrines appeared in sutras could be ascribed to the authority of Buddha himself. According to the earliest Pali Suttas, when Buddha became enlightened, he turned the wheel of Dharma. That is, he began to teach the path to enlightenment, the Dharma. Pali, Dhamma. While Buddhists had always maintained that Buddha had geared specific teachings to the specific capacities of specific audiences, the Sandinamokana Sutra established the idea that Buddha had taught significantly different doctrines to different audiences based on their levels of understanding, and that these different doctrines led from provisional antidotes, pratipaksha, for certain wrong views up to a comprehensive teaching that finally made explicit what was only implicit in the earlier teachings. In its view, the first two turnings of the wheel of the teachings of the Four Noble Truths in Nikaya and Abhidharma Buddhism, and the teachings of the Majjhimaka school, respectively, had expressed the Dharma through incomplete formulations that required further elucidation, niyatha, in order to be properly understood and thus effective. The first turning, by emphasizing entities, dharmas, aggregates, etc., while hiding emptiness, might lead one to hold a substantialistic view. The second turning, by emphasizing negation while hiding the positive qualities of the Dharma, might be misconstrued as nihilism. The third turning was a middle way between these extremes that finally made everything explicit nityatha. In order to leave nothing hidden, the Yogacarins embarked on a massive systematic synthesis of all the Buddhist teachings that had preceded them, scrutinizing and evaluating them down to the most trivial details in an attempt to formulate the definitive nityatha Buddhist teaching. Stated another way, to be effective all of Buddhism required a Yogacarin reinterpretation. Innovations in Abhidharma analysis, logic, cosmology, meditation methods, psychology, philosophy, and ethics are among their most important contributions. Asanga's magnum opus, the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, Treatise on the Stages of Yoga Practice, is a comprehensive encyclopedia of Buddhist terms and models, which draws heavily on the Agamas, the Sanskrit counterpart of the Pali Nikayas, mapped out according to his Yogacarin view of how one progresses along the stages of the path to enlightenment. Vasubandhu's pre-Yogacarin magnum opus, the Abhidharma Kosha, Treasury of Abhidharma also provides a comprehensive, detailed overview of the Buddhist path with meticulous attention to nuances and differences of opinion on a broad range of exacting topics. Though both half-brothers were born Brahmins, Asanga is believed to have early on joined the Mahisasikas, a non-Mahayana school of Buddhism deeply steeped in the Agamas. Asanga and Vasubandhu, who became the first identifiable Yogacharins, each having initially been devoted to other schools of Buddhism. Both were prolific authors, though Asanga attributed a portion of his writings to Maitreya, the future Buddha living in Tushita heaven. Some modern scholars have argued that this Maitreya was an actual human teacher, not the future Buddha, but the tradition is fairly clear. After 12 years of fruitless meditation alone in a cave, or forest according to other versions, during a moment of utter despair when Asanga was ready to quit due to his abject failure, Maitreya appeared to him and transported him to Tushita heaven, where he instructed him in previously unknown texts, Yogacharan works, that Asanga then introduced to his fellow Buddhists. Precisely which texts these are is less clear, since the Chinese and Tibetan traditions assign different works to Maitreya. According to tradition, Vasubandhu first studied Vaibhashika Buddhist teachings, writing an encyclopedic summary of their teachings that has become a standard work throughout the Buddhist world, the Abhidharma Kosha, Treasury of Abhidharma. As he grew critical of Vaibhashika teachings, he wrote a commentary to that work refuting many of its tenets. Intellectually restless for a while, Vasubandhu composed a variety of works that chart his journey to Yogacara, the best known of these being the Kamasiddhi Prakara, Investigation Establishing Karma, and Pankaskandhaka Prakara, Investigation into the Five Aggregates. These works show a deep familiarity with the Abhidharmic categories discussed in the Kosha, with attempts to rethink them. The philosophical and scholastic disputes of the day are also explored, and the new positions Vasubandhu formulates in these texts bring him closer to Yogacharan conclusions. A few modern scholars have argued, on the basis of some conflicting accounts in old biographies of Vasubandhu, that these texts along with the Abhidharma Kosha were not written by the Yogacharan Vasubandhu, but by someone else. Since the progression and development of his thought, however, is so strikingly evident in these works, and the similarity of vocabulary and style of argument are so apparent across the texts, the theory of two Vasubandhus has little merit. The writings of Asanga, and or Maitreya, and Vasubandhu ranged from vast encyclopedic compendiums of Buddhist doctrine. For example, Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, Mahayana Samgraha, Abhidharma Samukha, to terse versified encapsulations of Yoga, Chara Praxis, for example, Trimshika, Trisvabhavanirsha, to focused systematic treatises on Yogacara themes, for example, Vimshatika, Madhyanta Vibhaga, to commentaries on well-known Mahayanic scriptures and treatises such as the Lotus and Diamond Sutras. Since the Sandinomokana Sutra offers highly sophisticated, well-developed doctrines, it is reasonable to assume that these ideas had been under development for some time, possibly centuries, before this scripture emerged. Since Asanga and Vasubandhu lived a century or more after the Sandinomokana appeared, it is also reasonable to assume that these ideas had been further refined by others in the interim. Thus, the traditional claim that the two brothers are the founders of Yogacara is at best a half-truth. According to tradition, Asanga converted Vasubandhu to Yogacara after having himself been taught by Maitreya. He is not known to have had any other notable disciples. Tradition does assign two major disciples to Vasubandhu: Dignaga, the great logician and epistemologist, and Stiramati, an important early Yogacara commentator. It is unclear whether either ever actually met Vasubandhu. Current scholarship deems it unlikely. They may have been disciples of his thought, acquired exclusively from his writings or through some forgotten intermediary teachers. These two disciples exemplify the two major directions into which Vasubandhu's teachings split. After Vasubandhu, Yogacara developed into two distinct directions or wings. 1. A logico-epistemic tradition, exemplified by such thinkers as Dignaga, Dhammakirti, Shantarakshita, and Ratnakirti. 2. An Abhidharmic psychology, exemplified by such thinkers as Stiramati, Dharmapala, Xuanzang, and Vinodadeva. While the first, the logico-epistemic wing, focused on questions of epistemology and logic, the Abhidharmic psychology wing refined and elaborated the Abhidharma analysis developed by Asanga and Vasubandhu. These wings were not entirely separate, and many Buddhists wrote works that contributed to both. Dignaga, for instance, besides his works on epistemology and logic, also wrote a commentary on Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha. What united both wings was a deep concern with the process of cognition. That is, analyses of how we perceive and think. The former wing approached it epistemologically while the latter wing approached it psychologically and therapeutically. Both identified the root of all human problems as cognitive errors that needed correction. Several Yogacara notions basic to the Abhidharma wing came under severe attack by other Buddhists, especially the notion of Alavijnana, which was denounced as something akin to the Hindu notions of Atman, permanent, invariant self, and Prakriti, primordial substrate of nature from which all mental, emotional and physical things evolve. Eventually the critiques became so entrenched that the Abhidharma wing atrophied. By the end of the 8th century it was eclipsed by the logico-epistemic tradition and by a hybrid school that combined basic Yogacara doctrines with Tathagatagarbha thought. The logico-epistemological wing in part sidestepped the critique by using the term citta-santana, mindstream, instead of Alavijnana, for what amounted to roughly the same idea. It was easier to deny that a stream represented a reified self. On the other hand, the Tathagatagarbha hybrid school was no stranger to the charge of smuggling notions of selfhood into its doctrines. Since, for example, it explicitly defined Tathagatagarbha as permanent, pleasurable, self, and pure, nitya, sukha, atman, shuddha, many Tathagatagarbha texts, in fact, argue for the acceptance of selfhood, atman, as a sign of higher accomplishment. The hybrid school attempted to conflate Tathagatagarbha with the Alavijnana. Key works of the hybrid school include the Lankavatara Sutra, Ratnagatra Vibhaga, Uttara Tantra, and in China the Awakening of Faith. In China, during the 6th and 7th centuries, Buddhism was dominated by several competing forms of Yogacara. A major schism between orthodox versions of Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha hybrid versions was finally settled in the 8th century in favor of a hybrid version, which became definitive for all subsequent forms of East Asian Buddhism. Yogacara ideas were also studied and classified in Tibet. The Nyingma and Dzogchen school settled on a hybrid version similar to the Chinese Tathagatagarbha hybrid. The Gelugpas subdivided Yogacara into a number of different types and considered them preparatory teachings for studying Prasangika Majjhimaka, which Gelugpas rank as the highest Buddhist teaching. The Tibetans, however, tended to view the logico-epistemological tradition as distinct from Yogacara proper, frequently labeling that Sautrantika, an early school of Buddhism whose name means those who rely upon the sutras, to karma, matter, and cognitive appropriation. The key to Yogacara theory lies in the Buddhist notions of karma which they inherited and rigorously reinterpreted. As earlier Buddhist texts already explained, karma is responsible for suffering and ignorance, and karma consists of any intentional activity of body, language, or mind. Since the crucial factor is intent, and intent is a cognitive condition, whatever lacks cognition is both non-karmic and non-intentional. Hence, by definition, whatever is non-cognitive can have no karmic influence or consequences. Since Buddhism aims at overcoming ignorance and suffering through the elimination of karmic conditioning, Yogacarins reasoned that Buddhism is only concerned with the analysis and correction of whatever falls within the domain of cognitive conditions. Therefore, questions about the ultimate reality of non-cognitive things are simply irrelevant and useless for solving the problem of karma. Further, Yogacarins emphasize that categories such as materiality, rupa, are cognitive categories. Materiality is a word for the colors, textures, sounds, etc., that we experience in acts of perception, and it is only to the extent that they are experienced, perceived and ideologically grasped, thereby becoming objects of attachment, that they have karmic significance. Intentional acts also have moral motives and consequences. Since effects are shaped by their causes, an act with a wholesome intent would tend to yield wholesome fruits, while unwholesome intentions produce unwholesome effects. In contrast to the cognitive karmic dimension, Buddhism considered material elements, rupa, karmically neutral. The problem with material things is not their materiality, but the psychology of appropriation, upadana, desiring, grasping, clinging, attachment, that infests our ideas and perceptions of such things. It is not the materiality of gold that leads to problems, but rather our ideas about the value of gold and the attitudes and actions we engage in as a result of those ideas. Those ideas were acquired through previous experiences. By repeated exposure to certain ideas and cognitive conditions, one is conditioned to respond habitually in a similar manner to similar circumstances. Eventually these habits are embodied, becoming reflexive, presuppositional. For Buddhists, this process by which conditioning becoming embodied, samskara, is not confined to a single lifetime, but accrues over many lifetimes, samsara, the continuous cycle of birth and death, is the karmic enactment of this repetition, the reoccurrence of cognitive embodied habits and new life situations and life forms. For all Buddhists, this follows a simple sensory calculus: pleasurable feelings we wish to hold on to or repeat, painful feelings we wish to cut off or avoid, pleasure and pain, reward and punishment, approval and disapproval, and so on, condition us. Our karmic habits, vasana, are constructed this way. Since all is impermanent, pleasurable feelings cannot be maintained or repeated permanently. Painful things, such as sickness and death, cannot be avoided permanently. The greater the dissonance between our actual and permanent experience and our expectations for permanent desired ends, the more we suffer, and the greater tendency toward projecting our desires onto the world as compensation. Though nothing whatsoever is permanent, we imagine all sort of permanent things, from God, to soul, to essences, in an effort to avoid facing the fact that none of us has a permanent self. We think that if we can prove something is permanent, anything, then we too have a chance for permanence. The anxiety about our lack of self, and all the cognitive and karmic mischief that anxiety generates, is called several things by Yogacara, including Jñāvara, obstruction of the knowable, that is, ourself. Obsessions prevent us from seeing things as they are, and Abhuta Parikalpa, imagining something, namely permanence or a self, to exist in a locus in which it is absent. Previous Buddhists, most notably the Sautrantikas, but also the Abhidharma schools, had developed a sophisticated metaphoric vocabulary to describe and analyze the causes and conditions of karma in terms of seeds, bija. Just as a plant develops from its roots unseen underground, so do previous karmic experiences fester unseen in the mind. Just as a plant sprouts from the ground when nourished by proper conditions, so do karmic habits, under the right causes and conditions, reassert themselves as new experiences. Just as plants reach fruition by producing new seeds that re-enter the ground to take root and begin regrowing a similar plant of the same kind, so do karmic actions produce wholesome or unwholesome fruit that become latent seeds for a later, similar type of action or cognition. Just as plants reproduce only their own kind, so do wholesome or unwholesome karmic acts produce effects after their own kind. This cycle served as a metaphor for the process of cognitive conditioning as well as the recurrent cycle of birth and death, samsara. Since Yogacara accepts the Buddhist doctrine of momentariness, seeds are said to perdure for only a moment during which they become the cause of a similar seed that succeeds them. Momentary seeds are causally linked in sequential chains, each momentary seed a link in a chain of karmic causes and effects. Seeds are basically divided into two types, wholesome and unwholesome. Unwholesome seeds are the acquired cognitive habits preventing one from reaching enlightenment. Wholesome seeds, also labeled pure and unpolluted, give rise to more pure seeds, which bring one closer to enlightenment. In general, Yogacara differentiates inner seeds' personal conditioning from external seeds, being conditioned by others. One's own seeds can be modified or affected by exposure to external conditions. External seeds, which can be beneficial or detrimental. Exposure to polluting conditions intensifies one's unwholesome seeds, while contact with pure conditions, such as hearing the correct teaching, sadharma, can stimulate one's wholesome seeds to increase, thereby diminishing and ultimately eradicating one's unwholesome seeds. Another metaphor for karmic conditioning that accompanies the seed metaphor is perfuming, vasana. A cloth exposed to the smell of perfume acquires its scent. Similarly, one is mentally and behaviorally conditioned by what one experiences. This conditioning produces karmic habits, but just as the odor can be removed from the cloth, so can one's conditioning be purified of perfume habits. Typically, three types of perfuming are discussed. 1. Linguistic and conceptual habits. 2. Habits of self-interest and grasping self, atmagraha, that is, the belief in self and what belongs to self, and 3. Habits leading to subsequent life situations, bhavangavasana, that is, the long-term karmic consequences of specific karmic activities. Yogacara literature debates the relation between seeds and perfuming. Some claim that seeds and perfuming are really two terms for the same thing, viz. Acquired karmic habits. Others claim that seeds are simply the effects of perfuming, that is, all conditioning is acquired through experience. Still others contend that seed refers to the chains of conditioned habits one already has, whether acquired in this life, in some previous life, or even beginninglessly, while perfuming denotes the experiences one has that modify or affect the development of one's seeds. Beginningless might be understood as a corollary to Husserl's term transcendental, that is, a causal sequence constituting a present experience whose own original cause remains undisclosed in this experience. Some claim that one's possibilities for enlightenment depended entirely on the sort of seeds one already possessed. Perfuming merely acted as a catalyst but could not provide wholesome seeds if one did not already possess them. Beings utterly devoid of wholesome seeds were called Echanticus, incorrigibles. Such beings could never reach enlightenment. Some other Mahayana Buddhists, feeling that this violated the Mahayana dictum of universal salvation, attacked the incorrigibility doctrine. The karmic cause of the fundamental disease, dukkha, is desire expressed through body, speech, or mind. Therefore Yogacara focused exclusively on cognitive and mental activities in relation to their intentions, that is, the operations of consciousness. Since the problem was located there, Buddhism had always identified ignorance and desire as the primary causes of suffering and rebirth. Yogacarins map these mental functions in order to dismantle them. Because maps of this sort were also creations of the mind, they too would ultimately have to be abandoned in the course of the dismantling, but their therapeutic value would have been served in bringing about enlightenment. This view of the provisional expediency of Buddhism can be traced back to Buddha himself. Yogacarins describe enlightenment as resulting from overturning the cognitive basis, ashraya perivarati, that is, overturning the conceptual projections and imaginings, which act as the base of our cognitive actions. This overturning transforms the basic mode of cognition from consciousness, vijnana, discernment, into jnana, direct knowing. The V prefix is equivalent to dis in English, discriminate, distinguish, disengage, disconnect, meaning to bifurcate or separate from. Direct knowing was defined as non-conceptual, nirvikalpa jnana, that is, devoid of interpretive overlay. The case of material elements is important for understanding one reason why Yogacara is not metaphysical idealism. No Yogacara text denies materiality, rupa, as a valid Buddhist category. On the contrary, Yogacarins include materiality in their analysis. Their approach to materiality is well rooted in Buddhist precedents. Frequently Buddhist texts substitute the term sensory contact, Pali, Phasa, Sanskrit, Spasha, for the term materiality. This substitution is a reminder that physical forms are sensory, that they are known to be what they are through sensation. Even the earliest Buddhist texts explain that the four primary material elements, Mahabhuta, are the sensory qualities solidity, fluidity, temperature, and mobility, their characterization as earth, water, fire, and air, respectively, is declared an abstraction. Instead of concentrating on the fact of material existence, one observes how a physical thing is sensed, felt, perceived. Yogacara never denies that there are sense objects, but it denies that it makes any sense to speak of cognitive objects occurring outside an act of cognition. Imagining such an occurrence is itself a cognitive act. Yogacara is interested in why we feel compelled to so imagine. Everything we know, conceive, imagine, or are aware of, we know through cognition, including the notion that entities might exist independent of our cognition. The mind doesn't create the physical world, but it produces the interpretative categories through which we know and classify the physical world, and it does this so seamlessly that we mistake our interpretations for the world itself. Those interpretations, which are projections of our desires and anxieties, become obstructions preventing us from seeing what is actually the case. In simple terms, we are blinded by our own self-interests, our own prejudices, which means what is already prejudged, our desires. Unenlightened cognition is an appropriative act. Yogacara does not speak about subjects and objects. Instead, it analyzes perception in terms of graspers and what is grasped. Yogacara at times resembles epistemological idealism, which does not claim that this or any world is constructed by mind, but rather that we are usually incapable of distinguishing our mental constructions and interpretations of the world from the world itself. This narcissism of consciousness Yogacara calls vijñaptimātra, nothing but conscious construction. A deceptive trick is built into the way consciousness operates at every moment. Consciousness projects and constructs a cognitive object in such a way that it disowns its own creation, pretending the object is out there, in order to render that object capable of being appropriated. Even while what we cognize is occurring within our act of cognition, we cognize it as if it were external to our consciousness. Realization of vijñaptimātra exposes this trick intrinsic to consciousness's workings, thereby eliminating it. When that deception is removed, one's mode of cognition is no longer termed vijñāna, consciousness. It has become direct cognition, jnana. Consciousness engages in this deceptive game of projection, dissociation, and appropriation because there is no self. According to Buddhism, the deepest, most pernicious erroneous view held by sentient beings is the view that a permanent, eternal, immutable, independent self exists. There is no such self, and deep down we know that. This makes us anxious, since it entails that no self or identity endures forever. In order to assuage that anxiety, we attempt to construct a self, to fill the anxious void, to do something enduring. The projection of cognitive objects for appropriation is the main tool of consciousness for this construction. If I own things, ideas, theories, identities, material objects, then I am. If there are eternal objects that I can possess, then I too must be eternal. To undermine this desperate and erroneous appropriative grasping, Yogacara texts, for example, Madhyanta Vibhaga, say, negate the object, and the self is also negated. Yogacarins deny the existence of external objects in two senses. One, in terms of conventional experience, they do not deny objects such as chairs, colors, and trees, but rather they reject the claim that such things appear anywhere else than in consciousness. It is externality that they challenge, not objects per se. And, two, while such objects are admissible as conventionalisms, in more precise terms there are no chairs, trees, etc. These are merely words and concepts by which we gather and interpret discrete sensations that arise moment by moment in a causal flux. These words and concepts are mental projections. The point is not to elevate consciousness, but to warn us not to be fooled by our own cognitive narcissism. Enlightened cognition is likened to a great mirror that impartially and fully reflects everything before it, without attachment to what has passed nor in expectation of what might arrive. What sorts of objects do enlightened ones cognize? Yogacarins refuse to provide an answer aside from saying it is purified from karmic pollution, anashrava, since whatever description they might offer would only be appropriated and reduced to the habitual cognitive categories that are already preventing us from seeing properly. 4.8 Consciousnesses. The most famous innovation of the Yogacara school was the doctrine of eight consciousnesses. Standard Buddhism described six consciousnesses, each produced by the contact between its specific sense organ and a corresponding sense object. When a functioning eye comes into contact with a color or shape, visual consciousness is produced. When a functioning ear comes into contact with a sound, auditory consciousness is produced. Consciousness does not create the sensory sphere, but on the contrary is an effect of the interaction of a sense organ and its proper object. If an eye does not function but an object is present, visual consciousness does not arise. The same is true if a functional eye fails to encounter a visual object. Consciousness arises dependent on sensation. There are altogether six sense organs, eye, ear, nose, mouth, body, and mind, which interact with their respective sensory objects' domains. Visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and mental spheres. Note that the mind is considered another sense, since it functions like the other senses, involving the activity of a sense organ, manas, its domain, manodhatu, and the consciousness, manovijnana, resulting from the contact of organ and object. Each domain is discrete, which means vision, audition, and each of the remaining spheres function apart from each other. Hence deaf can see, and blind can hear. Objects, too, are entirely specific to their domain, and the same is true of the consciousnesses. Visual consciousness is entirely distinct from auditory consciousness, and so on. Hence there are six distinct types of consciousness: visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and mental consciousness. These 18 components of experience, viz. Six sense organs, six sense objects' domains, and six resulting consciousnesses, were called the 18 dhatus. According to standard Buddhist doctrine, these 18 exhaust the full extent of everything in the universe, or more accurately, the sensorium. Early Buddhist Abhidhamma, focusing on the mental and cognitive aspects of karma, expanded the three components of the mental level, mind, manas, mental objects, manodhatu, and mental consciousness, manovijnana, into a complex system of categories. The apperceptive vector in any cognitive moment was called citta. The objects, textures, emotional, moral, and psychological tones of citta's cognitions were called khetas. Khetas, lit, associated with citta, were subdivided into numerous categories that varied in different Buddhist schools. Some khetas are universal, meaning they are components of every cognition. For example, sensory contact, hedonic tone, attention, etc. Some are specialized, meaning they only occur in some, not all, cognitions. For example, resolve, mindfulness, meditative clarity, etc. Some khetas are wholesome. For example, faith, lack of greed, hatred, or misconception, tranquility, etc. Some unwholesome. Some are mental disturbances, klesha, appropriational intent, aversion, arrogance, etc. Or secondary mental disturbances, anger, envy, guile, shamelessness, etc. and some are karmically indeterminate, torpor, remorse, etc. As Abhidharma grew more complex, disputes intensified between different Buddhist schools along a range of issues. For Yogacara, the most important problems revolved around questions of causality and consciousness. In order to avoid the idea of a permanent self, Buddhists said citta is momentary. Since a new citta perceives a new cognitive field each moment, the apparent continuity of mental states was explained causally by claiming each citta, in the moment it ceased, also acted as cause for the arising of its successor. This was fine for continuous perceptions and thought processes, but difficulties arose since Buddhists identified a number of situations in which no citta at all was present or operative, such as deep sleep, unconsciousness, and certain meditative conditions explicitly defined as devoid of citta, asamjni samapatti, nirodha samapatti. If a preceding citta had to be temporally contiguous with its successor, how could one explain the sudden restarting of citta after a period of time had lapsed since the prior citta ceased? Where had citta, or its causes, been residing in the interim? Analogous questions were, from where does consciousness re-emerge after deep sleep? How does consciousness begin in a new life? The various Buddhist attempts to answer these questions led to more difficulties and disputes. Yogacarins responded by rearranging the tripartite structure of the mental level of the 18 dhatus into three novel types of consciousnesses. Manovijnana, empirical consciousness, became the sixth consciousness, and operated as the sixth sense organ, which previously had been the role of manas, surveying the cognitive content of the five senses as well as mental objects, thoughts, ideas. Full stop. Manas became the seventh consciousness, redefined as primarily obsessed with various aspects and notions of self, and thus called defiled manas, klishta manas. The eighth consciousness, alaya vijnana, storehouse consciousness, was totally novel. The storehouse consciousness was defined in several ways. It is the receptacle of all seeds, storing experiences as they enter until they are sent back out as new experiences, like a storehouse handles goods. It was also called vipaka consciousness. Vipaka means the maturing of karmic seeds. Seeds gradually matured in the repository consciousness until karmically ripe, at which point they reassert themselves as karmic consequences. Alaya vijnana was also called the basic consciousness, mula vijnana, since it retains and deploys the karmic seeds that both influence and are influenced by the other seven consciousnesses. When, for instance, the sixth consciousness is dormant, while one sleeps, or is unconscious, etc., its seeds reside in the eighth consciousness, and they restart when the conditions for their arising are present. The eighth consciousness is largely a mechanism for storing and deploying seeds of which it remains largely unaware. Cittas occur as a stream in alaya vijnana, but they mostly cognize the activities of the other consciousnesses, not their own seeds. For Yogacara, ignorance, avidya, in part means remaining ignorant of what is transpiring within one's own alaya vijnana. In states devoid of citta, the flow of cittas are repressed, held back, but their seeds continue to regenerate without being noticed, until they reassert a new stream of cittas. Storehouse consciousness acts as the pivotal karmic mechanism, but is itself karmically neutral. Each individual has its own storehouse consciousness which purges from moment to moment and life to life, though, being nothing more than a collection of ever-changing seeds, it is continually changing and therefore not a permanent self. There is no universal collective mind in Yogacara. Enlightenment consists in bringing the eight consciousnesses to an end, replacing them with enlightened cognitive abilities, jnana. Overturning the basis turns the five sense consciousnesses into immediate cognitions that accomplish what needs to be done, karatanushthana jnana. The sixth consciousness becomes immediate cognitive mastery, pratyavaksha jnana, in which the general and particular characteristics of things are discerned just as they are. This discernment is considered non-conceptual, nirvikalpa jnana. Manas becomes the immediate cognition of equality, samatha jnana, equalizing self and other. When the storehouse consciousness finally ceases, it is replaced by the great mirror cognition, mahadasha jnana, that sees and reflects things just as they are, impartially, without exclusion, prejudice, anticipation, attachment, or distortion. The grasper, grasped, relation has ceased. It should be noted that these purified cognitions all engage the world in immediate and effective ways by removing the self-bias, prejudice, and obstructions that had prevented one previously from perceiving beyond one's own narcissistic consciousness. When consciousness ends, true knowledge begins. Since enlightened cognition is non-conceptual, its objects cannot be described. Thus Yogacarins provide no descriptions, much less ontological accounts, of what becomes evident in these types of enlightened cognitions, except to say they are pure of imaginative constructions. One more Yogacara innovation was the notion that a special type of cognition emerged and developed after enlightenment. This post-enlightenment cognition was called Parashthalabdhajnana, and it concerned how one who has understood things as they actually become, Yathabhutam, now engages the world to assist other sentient beings in overcoming suffering and ignorance. 5. Three Self Natures. The Three Self Nature Theory, Trisvabhava, which is explained in many Yogacara texts including an independent treatise by Vasubandhu who devoted to the subject, Trisvabhava, Nirdesha Shastra, maintains that there are three natures or cognitive realms at play. 1. The conceptually constructed realm, Parakalpitasvabhava, ubiquitously imputes unreal conceptions, especially permanent selves, into whatever it experiences, including oneself. 2. The realm of causal dependency, Paratantrasvabhava, when mixed with the constructed realm, leads one to mistake impermanent occurrences and the flux of causes and conditions for fixed, permanent entities. It can be purified of these delusions by 3. The perfectional realm, Paranishpanasvabhava, which, like the Majjhimaka notion of emptiness on which it is based, acts as an antidote, Pratipaksha, that purifies or cleans all delusional constructions out of the causal realm. The conceptually constructed realm is the erroneous narcissistic realm in which we primarily dwell, filled with projections we have acquired and habituated and embodied. Paritantra, lit, dependent on other, emphasizes that everything arises causally dependent on things other than itself, that is, everything lacks self-existence. The perfectional realm signifies the absence of Swabhava, independent, self-existent, permanent nature, in everything. When the causally dependent realm is cleansed of all defilements it becomes enlightened. These self-natures are also called the three non-self-natures, since they lack fixed, independent, true, permanent identities and thus shouldn't be hypostatized. The first is unreal by definition, the third is intrinsically empty of self-nature, that is, it is the very definition of non-self-nature, and the second, which finally is the only real one, is of unfixed nature since it can be mixed with either of the other two. Understanding the purified second nature is equivalent to understanding dependent origination, Pratitya Samutpada, which all schools of Buddhism accept as Buddhism's core doctrine and which tradition claims Buddha came to realize under the Bodhi tree on the night of his enlightenment. 6.5 stages. Yogacara literature is so vast that one should not be surprised to find that many of its attempts to provide detailed systems run into conflict with each other. Since it was a self-critical scholastic tradition, it was not uncommon for Yogacara texts to discuss and criticize the positions of other Yogacara texts as well as their more obvious opponents. Yogacara positions on the stages of the path are diverse. The Dashabhumika Sutra Shastra, a commentary attributed to Vasubandhu on the 10 stages scripture, Dashabhumika Sutra, describes the progress of the Bodhisattva path to Mahayanic liberation in 10 stages. Comparable to the 10 stages implicit in the Mahayanic formulation of the 10 perfections of wisdom, Asanga's Yogacara Bhumi Shastra describes a series of 17 stages. There are other formulations, such as the 5-stage path that offers a useful overview of the other formulations. We will briefly summarize the 5-stage path as set out in Xuanzang's Chengwei Shilun 1. The first stage is called provisioning, Sambharavastha, since this is the stage at which one collects and stocks up on provisions for the journey. These provisions primarily consist of orienting oneself toward the pursuit of the path and developing the proper character, attitude and resolve to accomplish it. It begins the moment the aspiration for enlightenment arises, Bodhicitta. 2. The next stage is the experimental stage, Prayagavastha, in which one begins to experiment with correct Buddhist theories and practices, learning which work and which don't, which are true and which are not. One begins to suppress the grasped relation and begins to study carefully the relation between things, language, and cognition. 3. After honing one's discipline, one eventually enters the third stage, deepening understanding, Pratavedhavastha. Some texts refer to this as the path of corrective vision, Darshanamarga. This stage ends once one has acquired some insight in non-conceptual cognition. 4. Non-conceptual cognition deepens in the next stage, the path of cultivation, Bhavanamarga. The grasped relation is utterly eliminated as are all cognitive obstructions. This path culminates in the overturning of the basis, or enlightenment. 5. In the final stage, Nishthavastha, one abides in unexcelled complete enlightenment and engages the world through the 5 immediate cognitions, See above. All one's activities and cognitions at this stage are post-realization. As a Mahayanist, from the first stage one has been devoting oneself not only to one's own attainment of enlightenment, but to the attainment of enlightenment by all sentient beings. In this stage that becomes one's sole concern.